Hi, and welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Lauren Wolf, guest host of Prosody, and my guest today is the poet Melissa Barrett. Melissa Barrett's poems have recently appeared in Narrative, Gulf Coast, The Paris American, Web Conjunctions, and Best New Poets 2013. She is the recipient of an Ohio Arts Council Individual Excellence Award in Poetry, a Tin House Writers Scholarship, and a National Teaching Award from Building Excellent Schools. She lives and teaches in Columbus, Ohio. Hi, Melissa.
Hi.
Welcome to Prosody.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Would you begin by reading us some poems?
Definitely. I'm going to start with a poem called Yours, which is an address to the reader or listener. And the first four words of it, I should note, are from Carrie Wason's American Husband, a beautiful book. It's called Yours. I am your lather, your litter, your hamster, and Brita. Your first exit, the raw edit, a blank cassette, and basement carpet. Your sinkhole, your Cipro, your perfect Monday cup of joe, aspartame but hold the cream, a nest of gum, and a UFO. I'm in the details, the slaw, the tide, and cesspool. Beneath your roof slate, behind this word's fate, I'm the exception to your number one rule. Your rubies, your birthstone, the city of your birth. I'm a brothel of lost brothers, a buried urn full of dead earth. A backyard walnut, your neighborhood Walmart, and the Vietnam Wall, all at once. I'm your underwire, your underfire, your terrorism, and your hunch. Bone dry, bone white, I'm bow resin and hot air. Your horoscope, your hormones, I'm Florida this time of year. Your marbles and marvel, your alarm with fluorescent blaring, I wrote myself into your book, that nightmare on marrying. I do, your porch columns, lemonade, your made for TV, bad eBay trade. I'm your heteronormative childhood dollhouse. In a word, I'm harrowing. Rawhide to bromide and tooth white fluoride, I'm your orange rind, bad rhyme, fat black magpie. Step back in time or reread the lines, I'll be your very own Gertrude Stein. I repeat, there is no repetition. Only me and your DVDs and several allusions to tender buttons. Both eyelid and button, I'm the first day with a new razor. I'm crumbs, stone thumbs, and a dream you'll have later. Your West Coast and your next coat, Mount Holyoke and unsung holy notes. I'm a glinting gilded birdcage, but I let the bird go. I'm your magpie, your meatless pie, and meet me at three. Your opponent in mesh, vanishing in grass, that's me. Both beagle and bugle, worth millions as Bruegel's babble. I'm an ellipse, an eclipse, a list, and long lisp. I'm it, don't you see? Your mother confessor, your volume and possessor. I'm your horse, growing horse, your four-story floorboards, pro-beer but anti-course. Oh, glittering white-throated shores. Ain't gonna do mine, but I'll do your chores. Dear reader, sweet juror, I'm yours. And then I was going to read a few from my current manuscript, which is called Cold Holy Voice. And it centers on events from the Gilded Age, particularly the assassination of President Garfield. And something that many Americans don't know about, first of all, Garfield in general, his presidency, his legacy, but also that he was assassinated. And I came upon this several years ago when we had overseas visitors coming and we visited his tomb in Lakeview Cemetery in Cleveland and realized I have no idea what to tell our friends from Australia about President Garfield. I looked it up and learned all about him. He was shot on July 2nd, 1881, just a few months into his presidency, and he died about 2.5 months later. And his doctors couldn't find the bullet. And so by the time he died, it was an agonizing death, very painful. The bullet wound was a 3-foot gash. Everyone here is a tourist. Shipwreck and seaweed choking the tide. My anatomy, undone as flotsam, tipping between the hands of plate white waves. Only ice. I wish I were cold. When the pain was about the size and color of a plum, I used a lot of positive self-talk. I felt the water at my throat, but I coaxed it into smoke rings, coaxed those into Hiram in May, which means essentially daffodils. Pity I lost hold of that. The paper said we'd make it, and I was drunk enough on hope to believe them. The day I died, I told you I might be ready, ready or not. Was that a sin? I told you with a silver dollar stopped over each eye. The horse-drawn shadows have stopped circling on the veranda. They stagger toward me now. This is one from the perspective, kind of on the same topic, but from the perspective of his wife, Lucretia Randolph Garfield, who, while he was shot, was in Long Branch, New Jersey, recovering from malaria. So she was very sick and was kind of using the ocean air to help her recover and heard her husband. You know, there was an assassination attempt. This is called Purpose to Save. Ringing like a gang of coyotes. The wallpaper smudges. I don't sleep. I marry the moon, a covenant tacked to a mass of darkness. I never wanted the ocean. I wanted home, and now calomel. My teeth caramelize, my brain trip into my skull. The news cracks into me, a tumid arm dragging. Grace turns over like a jar. And when I leave the house, the swamp stares back at me, gratified and full. This is a poem from the perspective of Garfield's assassin, who was deranged. He was mentally ill, and this was kind of before the era of mental illness. He thought he would be heralded as a hero. His name was Charles Guiteau. He thought that the American public would call him a patriot instead of an assassin. And he believed this so confidently that from his jail cell, he launched his own lecture tour. He sold portraits of himself. And he even was tempted, he considered a presidential campaign. His thought was that God believed him. This was his one task in life. God led him to assassinate Garfield. And if he didn't do it, there would have been a second civil war and financial collapse. The Patriot, Guiteau. Incomprehensible to you, duty, gentlemen, my wrists cuffed to laws of no earthly magistrate. Wetly earnest, my words of a pitch decipherable only by the blondest choristers wading knee-deep in clouds, shimmering balustrades, stab me, hang me from your tallest brassy edifice, carve my sins as epitaph in a crawling script, but my soul is sanctified and yours damnable. What is prestige but lace black shoes? Your home lived according to a law writ by man when the greatest law was delivered from the peaks of stampeding clouds. I've already been saved. What's to stop him from again tangling your intentions, unnotching a noose? Your toys deliver a miniature justice. I'd rather die. Lash the color from my corpse, split me into a Venetian fan. I could hardly suffer more. I will be seated in the throne of thrones, most pious messenger in the employ of Jesus Christ and company, with Alphege, St. Felix, and Maurice, with the Carthusian martyrs. Careful, you could make me very happy. You could make of me a shrine, a legend rivaled only by our forefathers, those factious burgesses who themselves in nobility led by the hand of God, uncovered truth, nearly unattainable, knelling my ears, a sound so succulent yet unearthly, ambrosial, and yourself, poor Pontius.
If you just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Melissa Barrett. Well, Melissa, those poems are so rich. I have so many things that I want to ask you.
Thanks.
You're welcome. So going back to the very first poem that you read, the address to the reader, the I'm Yours poem, can you elaborate on what you mean by addressing the reader?
Yeah, definitely. I think of it as kind of a classic love poem where the beloved in this case is the reader. And for a while I was teaching, I was an adjunct, and now I'm a middle school teacher, and I'm in Ohio. I feel very disconnected from poetry world in many ways. And while I feel very connected as a reader of poetry, I often feel like I'm writing poems and kind of just producing them for my dogs and my apartment. So the idea of a reader was something really fabulous to me. And I wanted, once I was, kind of ironic that the first four words of that come from something I read, Carrie Wason's book. I really wanted to celebrate that idea of a readership and really go over the top with rhyme and the chaotic list that it is. I really wanted to be grandiose in my gratitude for a reader.
Oh, that's cool. I really like the list and the listing effect and the rhyme and the rhythm. Was that something you thought of prior to drafting, or did it come up afterwards?
It seemed just really natural. Again, the first four words I stole from Carrie Wason and just realized I just had to build on it. And it just became this giant construction. Yeah, the list was very natural to it.
That's cool. So moving on to these historical poems, I guess you would call them. So what is it like to work with historical material?
It is very strange for me. It's not something I have done before. It's kind of nice, though, because what it enabled me to do is forget the narrative in a way. I had done so much research on Garfield and his extended family and the assassin especially that I was able to just play with words and rhyme and sound and syntax. And I loved that because every poem in that manuscript is so different and I feel a different style. And I think that comes from the fact that the narrative, the arc of it was just down pat from the first poem I wrote. You know, it was all about this building events from the Gilded Age. And having that in place really enabled me to get wilder on the page with syntax and all those other elements.
So it's interesting you said that you could forget the narrative.
Yeah.
Where I think that a lot of times when poets are working with material like that, it's all narrative.
Yes.
So how did you do that?
Yeah, this is a good conversation. I'm actually currently having this conversation with my friend, a great poet, Anthony Madrid. We always go back and forth between narrative and sound. And for me, they're definitely very important. But I think the narrative for this manuscript was almost like so fascinating, but a box I could check off so that I could really play with the words in the way I wanted to play with them. So it does sound false in a way. How could you forget about this? It's in every single poem. But I guess that constant factor enabled me to not really have to do any heavy focus on it and really just play with the other elements.
Yeah. I guess I don't really mean like forget it as much as, you know, not focus each poem on being narrative driven, which is fascinating and difficult to do, you know?
Yes, definitely.
All right, great. Can you read some more poems?
For sure. This next one, again, it's hooked into a narrative. The Great Die-Up is the name of it. And this was an event that happened in 1886 in the winter of 1887. It was the result of a series of blizzards that swept through the West, which caused more than half of the country's cattle to march to their frost-bitten deaths. So a really horrifying event. And there's all sorts of accounts. Cowhands at the time said that, you know, when spring finally came and you opened your door, you couldn't see any patch of grass. It was just dead bodies of cattle for miles and miles. So really horrific event. This is called the Great Die-Up. My hooves break off in snow, are flat tracked, slain in a smash of clouds clapping. Switchgrass, spurge, clump inside sheaths of icy whips. The moon chimes, then shudders. How to move without the goad. The first incision, a white whistle. Track of nails. Stars warble in their brassy nests. The hills shrunk up, cold as mirrors, and my body a plank, a black pool, both swollen and compressed. Stung numb and bloodshot, sunk below the echoes. This next poem plays with palindromes. This is kind of getting back to that wordplay idea I was talking about before. It uses palindromes, which are, for the example, the title is Lived on Decaf, Face No Devil. So that's the same forwards and backwards. And it uses those throughout the poem to address and maybe mimic the cruelty of time, how words march forward and then revert back on themselves. And I might be a little bit of a stretch, but I connected this to the Garfield series because I was thinking of time and how if only President Garfield would have been shot 2 decades later, his doctors would have sterilized their equipment. This bullet wound would not, it was not a fatal shooting. He should have survived. But because he had a team of over 12 doctors inserting their fingers into his wound, he died of blood poisoning. And so this really came out of thinking, what if he would have been shot 2 decades later? Lived on decaf, faced no devil. One other note is, sorry about this poem, but Dr. James Lister was a British physician who at the time was championing sterilization practices. And even during the shooting, he had talked about this, but it just hadn't caught on quite enough yet. So he's mentioned in the poem. Lived on decaf, faced no devil. Around the same time that umbrellas went comfortably co-ed, you could walk the wet bridge without query, without being called queer, without the rain finding that quiet, white part of you. Of course it's white. Right around the time the umbrellas was painted, all those plump, chalked up cheeks, pre, post, and all throughout bad art, but before the telescopic folding umbrella ensconced our best gentlemen like silky attics. What a strange invention from the French, ombrelle. Of course it'd catch, except with the Puritans who spurned it because the rain is rain is rain is Jesus Christ, which was right around the time the Baron Jujiboy was busy distributing his lots to the poor. In 1858, that should have been the fashion. In 1958, it should have been law. 102 years before I was told that history repeats itself, but only the bad history, causing every window in my life to shatter again. So the rain fell harder, the gutters churning, worms upending. Hours later, the puddles were clouds because everything gets flipped around like that. Like my little cousin Hannah, the brat, named the same way, forward and back. 92,000 years before the dogbrella should have never been invented. 32 minutes ago, I walked my dogs in the rain, Puritan-like. When time travel is real, I'll walk them to the hall tree where Bliss's jacket hangs drizzly with spinal fluid. Make him suck on a carbolic smoke ball. Or the Zeit time ball, which was considered technology once. And then the big war started, the second one. I told you, only the bad history. And we never listen to living history, says Gramps, who fought in all the wars and walked uphill both ways. So he winds his watch but reads the porcelain dial backwards. Miasma's a good example. It was science before it wasn't, and now you need a permit to spray Glade in L.A. 3 hours before Mount Lister will become a frail raft, deleveled, speck of a speck, I'll drain my Listerine in the bay. Most people obsess over time, but not like this. I was raised in a house with more than 4,000 pocket watches and clocks. A pendulum swings in my chest. They're building amphibious homes now, houses suitable for frogs. The carbon is my heart burning like a goldenrod-adorned log. This one's called The Invention of the Metal Detector, which, again, goes back to the Garfield narrative. Alexander Graham Bell was asked to invent the metal detector in order to find the bullet lodged in the president's back. And he did. He successfully tested it under the gun and found bullets in Civil War veterans. He tested it on veterans who had bullets still in their limbs, and it worked. But when he got to the White House, somehow it went haywire, and they couldn't figure it out. Well, unfortunately, after the president passed away, they realized his bottom mattress, this was very unusual at the time, but his bottom mattress contained metal coils. And so what could have saved his life ultimately didn't because of his mattress. The invention of the metal detector. My desire was a dark horse, a monolith, simultaneously fraught with guilt, shrill-eyed and spinning like the mica in a marble shooter. I was tired. I would deign to shut my eyes once my eyes finally shut. And yet my sleeping was pregnant with intent. In a shrinking chapel, a bismuth mine, in glades that shattered though a citharus lulled us, wrens tumbled their way through turgid sails. Soap berries dripped from the boughs in wanderlust, dripped in pink waxen shadows, and your breath amaranthine, mine tagged with kite strings. Bluebell shivered up, love struck, the shad bushes pressed till dimension was dawn, and the lianas thieving across the trunks became quite at home. Today at Ben Brea, I woke up sucking on a tooth, a screw, no, on a net of woven steel wires.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Lauren Wolf, and my guest today is the poet Melissa Barrett. So, Melissa, your poems are so graciously and skillfully crafted. And I'm wondering if that's something that happens in revision, or do you write slowly, line by line? Do you come up with concept first and work from there? I mean, I know each poem is different, right? But
usually starts with a line an image or a pairing of words together. And for example, that last poem, The Invention of the Metal Detector, is just all about different words I loved. And I'd say concept is, again, kind of more in the shadows. It's not quite something I'm thinking about with these particular poems as much. It heavily revised for sure. Yeah. I write very slowly, and I'm very dependent on reading in order to write, which is kind of nice because I read a lot then, but I feel very heavily dependent on having to read a fantastic book of poems before I'm able to write a poem myself. And it's a very slow, tedious process.
Yeah, that's interesting because some people write line by line and don't do a lot of revision, and some people rely heavily on revision. So what have you been reading as you write these Garfield poems? Was there a particular text that helped you?
Yeah, good question. I would say all of D.A. Powell's books were really important to me as I wrote this. He's a stylist, and I think sonically his poems are beautiful. He also has a sense of humor that isn't necessarily in this batch of the Garfield poems, but comes out later in the manuscript. And I mentioned Carrie Wason already. Lucy Brock-Broido, I think, really knows the power of the weight of one word. She will probably always be a tremendous influence for me.
That's cool. Can you read some more poems?
Definitely. So this is another Alexander Graham Bell poem, and this one features his wife, Maybelle. After reading about Alexander Graham Bell, it was kind of hard not to make the whole manuscript about him.
Right, he's so fascinating.
He is super fascinating. And his wife, even more so, possibly. She was independently wealthy, and she funded many of his experiments in flight. Mm-hmm. She was also deaf. And what many people maybe don't realize about Alexander Graham Bell is a lot of his experiments were actually rooted in, including the telephone, had roots in trying to communicate with his deaf wife. Mm-hmm. This is called visible speech. First, there was the botched job of hitching Maybelle's ear to anything but isthmus and tundra, the job of giving voice to leather billets and a tulip's shudder. Then the fallen Ohioan, keening with eyes flat and lean as Bible paper. As I stepped into that room, the cords uncoiled and twitched in their casing. The cochlea slept. The walls hummed, suffused with prayer. I measured the balance in a demitasse cup. A dozen soldiers would attest to the low buzz of above a paltry shoulder, a birthmarked thigh. I planned for every variable but one. I planned for someone else to invent the way from death. I, too, left my wife a widow. Maybelle, who spoke as I lay dying. Maybelle, who couldn't hear the motor, but believed in flight.
I also appreciate, Mal, how you include the women, the narrative of the wives. Mm-hmm. That's a great sort of addition to the poems.
Yeah.
Was that something that you were going to do before, or you just...
It was very important to me. The manuscript, is, you know, it's history, and it's in the 1880s, so there's lots of white men. But one of the poems in the manuscript is from the perspective of Anna Julia Cooper, who was freed from slavery, and she became the first African-American woman to receive her PhD from the Sorbonne. This next one I was going to read is from the perspective of Guiteau's sister, Frances, who took on a maternal role after their mother died while they were both pretty young. And he lived with her, and it was her husband who became his lawyer in that very important case. And when he was found guilty, what this poem kind of centers on is this last act of compassion from her, this last action that she took to really care for him. She visited him in jail, and he was found to be guilty and was going to be hanged. And she knew that was his, you know, biggest fear. He would die another way, but he did not want to be hanged. And so she went to visit him in jail carrying a bouquet of flowers, and inside the flowers had a vial of arsenic so that he could poison himself. And ideally, if that plan worked, that would have been great, but it was discovered, and so he was hanged. It's called Paraclete. Once I was so patient. Once I was mousy and tender, and I put out always. Once you ought to have seen me growing up in that teeny house with the five babies, and mom just died, and dad thought Jesus came back to the earth in the year 70 AD. Once I had the cracking and busted up hands of a poor farmer. Once I was a mother at the age of 9. This is the period I will refer to as my actual insanity, my internment, my lonely making, also known as my horrible secret, continent-wide. You know that expression, all good things must be annihilated. Well, lesions split up behind my ears like slugs inking their way toward my eyes. I soon became blind, blind and simultaneously able to understand everything perfectly. I was the most intelligent person in Illinois, and so it was with ease that I discovered that I lived inside of a prison, inside of a prison. With the dawn of my intelligence, my husband, he's a lawyer, he examines land, called on an alienist. The alienist asked me to empty my pockets. I dramatically turned my pockets completely inside out. What could I have? What have I ever had? I had a little teeny tiny silver-plated bell in my breast pocket. During my internment, I was as silent as the crown molding, which was unpeeling, as the land my husband examines, all that red peanutly dirt, as kneading and kneading. The alienist held out his hand expectantly. I clutched the little bell until I felt its clapper slide against my palm. This I intuited as a request. I clutched the little bell until it pulverized. And the alienist, he forcibly clenched my fist, dumped the powder into his drawstring pouch, and then he licked between my fingers all the rest of that fine baby blue dust. He insisted on looking me dead in the eyes while he was licking. He did not know that I identified as blind. But I had another bell, an invisible bell that I saw in my mind, and I could listen to it just by blinking. When I slept, a clatter of angel hair wound itself around me. When I slept, no one in the world would lick my fingers. Pretend for a minute that you are me. Pretend the papers have declared your husband to be a horse's ass. Pretend your brother wrote the Bible, part two. Pretend your brother once chased you with an axe and then murdered the president. And by the president, I mean the president. For how many seconds could you remain contrite and hummingbird-like? And then please recall how I flitted around like a hummingbird for decades, for roughly all my life. This is why I was able to give my body, but not my mind, that asylum. You know the old saying, mind over your pasty waterlogged limbs. Yes, they tried to drown it out of me, some new experimental treatment. My feet were permanently pruned, my ankles forever blue, my body altogether hairless and stooping. They say the lack of empathy is a dead ringer for insanity. I have a new theory. Too much empathy will singe a small hole, just barely noticeable, into your soul. And each day you live your magnanimous life, the hole grows and it grows until eventually it becomes a universe. And every piece of you sinks toward its bottom, which is a giant rusted drain inexorably swallowing all of you. Your consciousness is last, but it too slips through. And the only thing left is the one tear you saved, your final lament for the state of the world. And when that dribbles out, truly, truly, you are left with nothing. It will also ruin a marriage. My most empathetic gesture was the day I walked those dirt floors to your holding cell, my bouquet smiling up into your tired pink eyes, nasturtium, gladiola, sunflowers, the dandelion head snapped off and floated up, a symbol of hope, some promise of brightness. I've never been as tender as the day I asked you to end your life. I'm going to end with a poem that's a newer poem. And again, it's kind of plays with the wordplay. It's called A French Interior as the Voice of Trauma. The shrubs rub into leaves, leaves left in corners penny red. A dirt path around the side, a dirty life. Leave it, think of it, a cottage, sloping squat, sodden, battered sky. One lamp limply on, the glow more gray than gold. Coins pile in corners carved in shadow, wooden cabinets wink closed. Old homes have character. Sometimes they are characters. Holmes is my shelter. Holden Caulfield is an American Foursquare. The page is tea-stained, stains steeped in age. Strewn lily stems as the garden pageant wanes. Wind me down, I'm winded. Like the wings of ivy wiping the wisteria green, leave me. Close the door on my wooden, unwound quiet. I'm ready for unraveling. I just don't want to dread it.
The poetry of Melissa Barrett. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. That was great.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a biweekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.